First, I would like to go about and tell you about the techniques which are available to detect virus or a pathogen from any particular kind of sample. Electron microscopy is a very famous technique. It had been widely used in the past, and even today, though there are many modern techniques which are available to detect viruses, electron microscopy is very much used. It can be used in rapid detection, where you want to look into the pathogen morphology, or it could also be used in many other ways. Now, cytology and histology is also very popular. Generally, in clinical samples, scientists, they look at the pathology or the histology of the cell culture or any other pathogen. Antigen detection is another popular technique where you look into the antigen-antibody reaction. Generally, the antibodies, they are labeled, say fluorescently labeled, and that gives you the reaction and you know that your virus is present. Molecular detection, it is again very famous today. We know a lot about the sequences of viruses, so you could take your sample, simply go ahead and do a PCR amplification of that particular virus, followed by gel electrophoresis, where you look at the bands, and depending on the band size, you can tell whether or not the virus of interest is present, and you could again go ahead and sequence your virus to again confirm that indeed the virus you are looking for is present in the system. Now, the last two systems I have listed here is more to do with live cultures. So the first one is the cell or tissue culture. As we know, generally a virus, it cannot grow or multiply by itself, so it generally needs a host. So many cell and tissue culture systems have been developed which could be used as a host, where you could infect your virus into this tissue culture system. The virus then grows into the system, and it could act in two ways. First, it could either invade the cell line, burst open and kill the cell line, or in other cases, it could cause a morphological change in the cell system, and then our electron microscopy comes in handy, where you could look at the morphological changes in the cell and look for the presence of the virus. But today I'm going to focus my talk basically on the embryonated chicken egg technique, which, as Alex said, we used to detect virus, basically exotic Newcastle disease virus, from flies. Little bit about the history of using this particular technique. So initially, scientists, they started looking into bacterial viruses or bacteriophages. So when they started researching on phages, they had a good handle about the cell interaction between the host as well as the pathogen. They knew how to grow the bacterial cultures, infect them with the virus, and so on and so forth. But then when they started working with animal viruses, they didn't have any idea about the cell-virus interaction. So they came up with this cool idea where they could take the animal viruses and study it outside the diseased organism, and they tried to inject it into developing embryos, and particularly they used chicken embryos to study the particular virus. Now, it was first attempted in 1902 by Centeny, just after World War II. Little bit about the structure of an embryonated chicken egg. As we all know, the chicken egg has a hard shell on the outer side. This shell is lined by a membrane, that is the eggshell membrane, which surrounds the whole eggshell from the inner side. And on the blunt end of the eggshell membrane is the air sac. Now, both the eggshell as well as the eggshell membrane, they maintain the microbiological integrity of the egg, as well as they allow for the diffusion of gases inside and outside of the egg. Now, the diffusion of the gases within the egg is controlled by what is known as the chorioallantoic membrane. Now, the chorioallantoic membrane, during its development, it goes ahead and it forms a huge sac or a cavity, which is known as the chorioallantoic cavity. Now, this cavity is really important, and this and the chorioallantoic membrane, it forms like the respiratory organ of the embryo, and it helps the embryo breathe in. And this cavity, it consists of the of a fluid known as the allantoic fluid. It is 5 to 10 milliliters in volume, and this is very important, as I'll go ahead in my presentation and tell you the importance of this. And the embryo, the chick embryo, is directly bathed in the amniotic fluid, which consists of the amniotic sac, and it is also attached to the yolk sac. Now the yolk sac, it provides the nourishment and the nutrition needed for the embryo to grow. So what all do we require in order to do this technique? We generally need fertile eggs, which should be less than a week old. Now the eggs should be free of any specific pathogens. And we need to make sure that the breeder flocks from where we are getting the eggs, they have been monitored for common avian viral and bacterial pathogens. So generally, the supplier who's providing you with the eggs, it is good practice to ask them for the battery of tests they have performed in order to know whether or not there is any specific pathogen which the eggs might contain, which might compromise the detection of your virus. It is also good to check the egg yolks for the presence of antibodies. Even though generally all the detection techniques, they use fertile eggs which are between 10 to 11 days old, and the resorption of all the antibodies from the yolk into the embryo, it takes place only on day 15, but it's a good practice to use eggs which do not have any antibodies in their yolk. And finally, it is good to know about the genetic constitution of the breeder flock, such as some flocks are naturally resistant to some strains of viruses, such as the avian leukosis virus. Now, the type of specimen you want to test for the presence of virus might be either a tissue sample, or it could be a swab, or it could be feces. Now, you take the sample and you prepare a suspension in a medium. Now, your medium could be a nutrient broth or brain heart infusion broth or anything which is available. Now, you make a suspension of the sample in this nutrient broth, and to this you add antibiotics. Again, the amount of antibiotics you're trying to use would totally depend on the kind of sample you're dealing with, as you might intuitively think that if you're dealing with feces, they would have more bacterial contamination, so you might like to adjust the amount of antibiotics you're using to go through this process. So now you have the specimen in suspension and you've added the antibiotics. You would homogenize the specimen in the sample, in the solution, centrifuge it, take the supernatant and go ahead and inject it into the embryonated chicken egg. Now at times, even after homogenizing and centrifuging the samples, you find a lot of bacterial contamination. So in that case, you would go ahead and filter the sample using a 450 nanometer membrane filter, and then re-centrifuge it and take the supernatant and again inject it into the egg. Now there are, now that we have our sample prepared, we have to decide where exactly in the egg we want to inject our sample. Now there are four common routes of inoculating a chicken egg. Now it totally depends on the purpose and the agent we want to inoculate. So we have to keep in mind whether our objective is virus isolation, or we want to quantitate the infected particle in the virus, or do we want it for serological agents. So based on these three criteria, we determine where exactly in the egg do we want to inoculate our sample. Just to show you the pictures of the routes of inoculation, either you could inoculate it right into the amniotic sac, which surrounds the embryo, or you could inject the sample in the chorioallantoic membrane, which is just underneath the air cavity of the egg. You could also inject your sample right into the yolk sac, or you could go ahead and inject your sample into the allantoic fluid. So in the past, the chorioallantoic membrane was inoculated a lot. Again, as I had mentioned earlier, the routes of inoculation, they highly depend on the purpose or your objective of virus isolation. The next most common techniques of inoculation are either the yolk or the allantoic sac. Also the chorioallantoic sac, it is pretty popular because, as I told you, the chorioallantoic sac consists of the allantoic fluid, and it is around 5 to 10 mils. So if you can inject your virus into that particular allantoic sac, then you get a high yield of antigens, and you could use it for preparing vaccines. So the eggs are generally maintained at 38 to 39 degrees centigrade and with a relative humidity of 60 to 70%. It is very important to turn the eggs several times a day, otherwise the embryo, it might get stuck to the membrane of the egg. And it's also important to see that the embryo is maintained at the center of the egg. Now the period of inoculation, it depends on the route of inoculation, but it generally is between 6 to 11 days. And it is also important to candle the eggs very frequently, so that if there are any fertilized eggs which are of inferior quality, or you find out that they are infertile, or the embryo inside the egg has died, it is important to go ahead and remove it before you inject the pathogen. Here is a picture which shows how an egg is candled. It is basically held under a flashlight kind of a system, and you look for the embryo inside the egg, and that's how you make the decision. So you take a 10 to 11 day old embryonated chicken egg and you candle it, and you put a pencil mark just on top of the egg cavity, where you make sure that there aren't many veins which are crossing through, and that would be your site of incubation. Now that site of incubation, you would go ahead and disinfect it. After disinfecting, you would puncture a hole in there, and using a syringe, you would go ahead and inject your sample into the embryonated chicken egg. And it is important to seal the hole. We generally use Elmer's glue to seal the hole, and then you go ahead and you incubate it for 5 to 7 days and look for the pathology in the embryonated chicken egg. So once you have the samples inside your chicken egg, you would again candle the eggs. If you find that the eggs have died, you would go ahead and refrigerate them. It is important to rapidly refrigerate them, otherwise there'll be a lot of bacterial contamination in the eggs. And the embryos which die within the first 24 hours, they are generally discarded because it is considered it has died either due to bacterial contamination or you have caused injury while you were trying to inject your syringe through the chicken embryo. Also, the embryos which live the first 7 days of incubation, it is important to go ahead and chill it overnight to kill the embryos and let the blood clot, because you don't want to hatch out any chicks which have these infective pathogens. So now that you've refrigerated your eggs which have the pathogen, it is important to pull out the sample and test it. So you would again do the same thing, take the eggshell, disinfect it, crack it open, take a pair of sterile forceps, slowly remove the egg membrane, the chorioallantoic membrane, take a syringe and go ahead and pull out the amnioallantoic fluid. At this point, you're dealing with too many numbers of eggs, so you have to keep in mind that you don't cross-contaminate your samples. That would give you negative results. Now, at times, the virus is not detected in the first passage. There isn't enough virus to amplify in the egg itself, so it is very essential to do many more blind passages. So you simply take out the allantoic fluid from the previous passage and go ahead and inject it into another set of eggs. After you've got the fluid from the egg, it is important to do some tests in order to confirm that the pathogen or the virus you are looking for is indeed present in your sample and your eggs didn't die of some other virus or something, some other pathology. So the two most common tests which are used to detect the presence of virus are the hemagglutination test and the hemagglutination inhibition test. Once you've performed these two tests, the next thing you want to do is determine the amount of virus which was present in your sample, and you do this by estimating 50% endpoints. I'll talk a little bit about all the three of these. So what is hemagglutination assay? So generally many pathogens, they have a glycoprotein, that's the hemagglutinin, which is expressed on the surface of these pathogens. Now, well, these hemagglutinins can be easily detected by adding erythrocytes or RBCs to these, which have a complementary receptor to the hemagglutinins. So we make use of this technique where you have the virus and you add the chicken red blood cell or erythrocyte. If the receptor is present, the erythrocyte will bind and it will agglutinate the pathogen. So here is an example of a typical hemagglutination assay plate. So here the virus has been diluted twofold horizontally across, and the rows A, B, C, D, E, and F, they represent different kinds of viruses. So this technique also helps us to determine the amount of virus or the highest dilution at which the virus would still agglutinate. So if we look at row A, here we find that the agglutination reaction went through at 1, 2, and 3 dilutions. Similarly, in this case, 1, 2, 3, and 4 dilutions. And at this particular dilution, we can see that there wasn't enough virus present for the erythrocytes to bind, so we would call these as negative results. So after performing the hemagglutination assays, we go ahead and do what is known as the hemagglutination inhibition assays. Well, this is totally opposite of hemagglutination assays. In this case, we provide the virus with an antibody so that there is an antigen-antibody reaction, and to this when we add an erythrocyte. Now, since the erythrocyte cannot bind to this as the antigen-antibody reaction has already taken place, it will fall through the reaction and it will settle down as a button or a pellet. So here is an example of an hemagglutination inhibition assay plate. Here the sera or the antibody has been diluted 1:5 times vertically down. So if we take the example of this particular series, we don't see any pellet forming even at the highest dilution. So we would call this particular virus to be either negative for this particular antibody, or we would say that this particular virus is positive at even lesser dilution or higher dilutions. The next thing we would like to estimate is the 50% endpoint. By this we mean that the amount of agent that is capable of infecting 50% of the hosts. It is a unit of infectivity, also expressed as the mean infective dose or ID50. ID50 is the recommended procedure. It's the recommended procedure to express the infective agents. ID50 could be expressed either as EID50, depending on the technique you're using. If you're using embryonated chicken egg technique, then you would call it EID50, or if you're using a tissue culture technique, then you would call it TCID50. And again, it helps us calculate the concentration or the titer of the viral solution. Here is a quick formula that is used to estimate the 50% endpoints. Just as an example, I've put in a case study. In this particular table, this column shows the viral dilutions that were in study, and these two columns, they show the number of embryos that were dead or alive. When we take all these values and we plug it into this formula, for this particular case, we got 10 to the power 5.9 ID50s per mil of homogenate as the titer or the endpoint. Let's talk a little bit about the advantages of using the embryonated chicken egg technique. Now, the embryonated chicken egg technique is one of the most sensitive techniques for primary isolation of viruses. It is also very useful for preparation of high-titered serologic agents or for producing vaccines. Eggs are relatively inexpensive. You can get them very easily, and they're very easy to handle. As well as infected fluids and membranes, they provide a large amount of viral material, so you can get a very high output of the vaccine you are looking for. Embryos, they appear to be unable to form antibodies against the inoculated agent in that particular time span. Also, the infected egg fluids are relatively free from foreign proteins. And most interestingly, this particular technique tells us that indeed there is live virus present in our system. If we compare this to the current day molecular tools, well, PCR would go ahead and detect even small amounts of dead virus present in a sample. But if we go through an embryonated chicken egg procedure, it would tell us that indeed our sample had live virus in it. And this technique is also very valuable for comparison with previous research, because most of the previous research, they report their titers as EID50 or ID50. So we can go ahead and compare our results to that of the previous results. We have to always keep in mind the age of the embryo. It should be around 10 to 11 days, the route of inoculation, the dilution as well as the volume of the inoculum, the temperature of incubation as well as the time of incubation. Now, each and every infectious agent or virus you're dealing with needs to be optimized for all these conditions. Here in this table, I found a list of all these infectious agents. You need to take care of the age of embryo. Just to highlight one example, if you're dealing with Newcastle disease virus, the age of the embryo should be 11 days. You should inject the virus into the allantoic sac. You should inject 0.2 mils of the virus, so on and so forth. So what I'm trying to tell you is that for each and every virus, you really need to optimize the conditions you're looking for in order to use this particular technique. As per all techniques, even embryonated chicken egg procedure has some limitations. The first limitation is you need to use totally sterile material for embryo incubation. As I mentioned in my earlier slide, you need to optimize all the methods for the particular virus in need. And also, viruses which multiply freely, you need to confirm the identity of that particular virus by performing many tests, as I explained, either the HA test, HI test, or you need to sequence the virus. The other most concerning point about this is that the time of detection. It takes around 7 to 10 days to confirm the identity of the virus and to isolate the virus. So of course, if you need a rapid detection technique, embryonated chicken egg procedure is not a very rapid detection tool. Now I would like to illustrate upon the little bit of research we did where we tried to find out whether or not virus was present in house flies. We are dealing with exotic Newcastle disease virus. To tell you a little bit about exotic Newcastle disease virus, it affects the respiratory, nervous and digestive system of poultry and other birds. It is highly virulent and contagious, and it causes 100% mortality in unvaccinated poultry. Here's a picture of birds showing the symptom of exotic Newcastle disease virus infection, and these are healthy birds. Now, this virus could be transmitted either directly by contact with infected birds, or it could be transmitted indirectly by contaminated personnel and equipment moving from one facility to the other. And regulations require strict quarantine of infected premises. In the United States, we have had two major outbreaks of this virus. One was in 1971, and the last major outbreak was in 2002-03. We went ahead and collected a few flies from two backyard poultry facilities. We found 9 species of flies. Again, we used embryonated chicken egg procedure to isolate the virus. All the research was done at Southeast Poultry Research Lab. And we found these 3 species of flies to be positive for exotic Newcastle disease virus. We did a monoclonal antibody test where we tested the virus isolated from these flies with the outbreak strain. We see that the pattern was similar, which told us indeed that the virus we got back from our flies was similar to that in the poultry. We did some sequencing and we found our virus to be pretty similar to the O2-O3 outbreak virus. And the next question we had in mind was to know if the flies were indeed getting infected by the virus, how long could it carry the virus, and what's the site of harborage of the virus? So we took a cage full of flies, fed them virus-infected meal, and sampled for 10 days. We also did some dissections in order to know where exactly the virus resided in the flies. Here is the result. So these are the 2 fly species we looked into, the house fly and the little house fly. And over time, we could see that virus was present in the flies till day 5. And this line represents the infective dose for a bird. So the flies did carry a dose which was infective to a bird up till 4 days. So this helped us determine that, yes, indeed, flies can carry exotic Newcastle disease virus. Therefore, we really need to look into fly control when dealing with exotic Newcastle disease virus in a poultry facility. So I would like to conclude by saying that today many techniques are available. We need to be very careful. We need to know about the objectives in mind and then look for a suitable technique to isolate the virus. With that, I would stop and take any questions. Thank you.
There's time for a question or two. The HAHI process, the whole thing is very laborious, obviously, and I remember you doing that.
Yes.
The HAHI part of that, what's the value in those tests? Is it strictly, I know there's a lot of types of these viruses, is that the point of it? Is it a typing assay?
Yes, it's kind of a typing assay as well as it tells us about the titer, the dilution, the lowest dilution at which the virus could be positive.
I was thinking perhaps you could replace that with a PCR step, right? Unless you're doing real-time PCR, you shouldn't get the
concentration. Yes, you wouldn't get the concentration. That's a good question. We did find the virus to reside in the gut of the flies too, but we cannot really pinpoint and say exactly which part. It could also be a mechanical vector. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you so much.